Tonight to the book of Esther, chapter number one. Esther, chapter number one. I was talking to some of the teenagers before church and told them it took me 40 minutes to preach on one verse this morning. Tonight we're going to go through a whole book of the Bible. I asked them how long that was going to take. And some of them didn't look happy for some reason. So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to try to tell the story of Esther, and we're going to go through and look at some verses. And this is one of the sermons in our Declare His Glory series. We're going to talk about how Mordecai declares his glory. This morning, John chapter 3, something 16 I've preached on a number of times in my life. Esther is something I've only preached on a few times in my life, and it's always on that verse for such a time as this. So this is not as familiar territory for me when we're preaching, but I think most of us have a good understanding of the story. And then at the end, we're going to look at some of the different ways that we're going to look at it from Mordecai's side more than Esther's side. And we're going to look at how Mordecai declared the glory of God, because I believe he was Esther's adopted father, but I think that happened at a young age, and how that all transpired. So we're going to look here, I'm going to tell this story, and at the end, you're going to see how God gets the glory out of it, and how from this man's life, and from his encouragement, and the way he raised Esther, and his encouragement to Esther, God was able to use him, and God was able to lift him up. And there's some just really cool things in the book of Esther. Someday, I plan on looking at it and preaching through it on a Wednesday night or Sunday morning, Sunday school, whatever the Lord leads, but that's not going to be anytime soon. But I was looking for Bible characters, the Lord, talking about how God used someone to declare his glory. The Lord brought me to Mordecai, and last time we talked about it was David. Everybody knows the story of David and Goliath. I mean, everybody, that's a great story. Not as many people know about Mordecai. I want you to think about Mordecai from what I see in the Bible and from the story I get. Mordecai was probably kind of like a low level, mid level. He sat in the gate. He did things in the gate. So he really was pretty much a nobody. Didn't know any. Nobody really knew who he was. Didn't really know much about him. He was not somebody who was, lifted up in his high position. Later on, that happens. You say, what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. That's great. That's the majority of the people in the world. And that's the point here tonight. He's not some type of flaming pastor or evangelist or a priest or a prophet. He is just simply a man who loves God and a man who going to serve God and wants to lift God up, and he wants to declare his glory. And at the end, he gets exalted up. And even when he gets exalted, you're going to see how he uses his position, not for his own self, but for the good of others. Let's go ahead. And like I said, we're going to try to read through the story, tell it. And then at the end, we're just going to say four or five different little thoughts or points, not really points, but more thoughts that try to reemphasize the things that we already learned. So I like the book of Esther, some really cool things in there, some things that I think that's good for ladies to understand, some good things for parents to understand, some good things for men to understand too, and young people. So we're going to have to skip through a lot, obviously, because we're not going to be able to expound on 10 chapters, but we are going to try to tell the story here. First, in Esther chapter number 1, we're going to look at verses 1 through 4. It says, now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. Now this is the Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even into Ethiopia over 127 provinces. So what happened is when the Jews were allowed to go back to Jerusalem, and they were allowed to rebuild the temple, were allowed to rebuild the wall, probably only about 60,000 went back. How do we know that? That's from the book of Ezra, from the book of from Nehemiah, and also I believe from Haggai and Zechariah. They give those pictures and those numbers. Now, what about the rest of the Jews? What about the other millions? What happened to them? Well, they had settled down in jobs and positions throughout the kingdom. Well, Ahasuerus is the one that is actually in charge. He's the king. He's pretty much the emperor of the known world at that point in time, at least the world emperor in a sense. That in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast. Now think about this feast, unto all his princes and his servants. He said, well, how many is that? Well, you go up to verse number 1, it says over 127 provinces. So he had a lot of princes, he had a lot of servants. This is a big feast, and media, and the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days. What does that mean? It means he was showing off. Now, he was having his feast. He was showing off to all his princes and everything else. Now, look how long this feast lasted. Even 104 score days. I know to have a fellowship around here is a production. You know, it's a lot of work, a lot of setup, a lot of this, a lot of that, a lot of cleanup. Can you imagine for 180 days having a feast, having a party for that long? Well, verse number 5, you see a second feast. It says, and when these days were expired, when this first feast was expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both unto the great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So they had this first feast, all the princes, all the big name people, even his servants. Now these next 7 days, I'm guessing because the people helped maybe pitch in at the first feast, he says, okay, we're going to have our own feast. And it describes it in verses 6 and 7. We won't go there. Verse number 8. Begins a little insight of what's going on at this feast. And the drinking was according to the law, and none did compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Just like, do what you want, drink as much as you want. Also, Vashti, the queen, made a feast for the women. So over here, you got your men, and the king is hosting a feast for the men. And over here, you have Vashti, the queen, that's hosting a feast for the ladies. So you see two different things going on. And so we keep on going in this verse number 9. She made a feast for the women in the royal house, which belongeth to King Ahasuerus. Skip down to verses 15 and 16. The king kind of, it says he's merry with wine. It means he's drunk. He says, look, I want to bring my wife in. She's beautiful. I want to show her off. And, you know, some lewd different things. I think the king is interested in the wife. And you know what? The king says no. The queen says no. And the queen says in verse number 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment. So you see here that king's drunk. He wants his wife, wants to come show off his wife. Vashti says, no, I'm not going to be a part of that. He said, well, what's the big deal? Well, in our culture today, if a wife tells a husband no about something, it's not as big of a deal, at least in the culture that we have. Vashti telling the emperor of the world no, there's a difference there. He probably never really happened to him before. He doesn't really even know how to respond. And in verses 15 and 16, the king kind of is like, well, what are we going to do? My wife said no to me. What am I supposed to do? You know how many times I would have counseling sessions if men came to me and says, what am I supposed to do? My wife said no to me. I mean, that would happen a lot, wouldn't it? So verses 15 and 16, it says, what shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to the law, because she hath not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen hath not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princesses and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. What they're saying here is, look, Vashti just didn't do something bad to you. Now my wife thinks she can say no to me. We're going to have to do something about Vashti. We're going to have to make, an example of Vashti. And they get this, and the way this happens, they pretty much vanish Vashti. She's gone. You didn't listen, you're gone. And that's, you say, well, why are you telling that? Well, this is in the Bible. This is the story of how Esther becomes queen. Well, verse number 1, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti. He missed his wife. Before he says, okay, let's go ahead and get rid of her. And that's what it talked about. And these princes and all these other people, they're like, okay, what we can do is we can get rid of her, vanish her, and she can't come back to you anymore. That would teach her a lesson. Well, after a while, Ahasuerus, he gets appeased. That's what happens with angry people. Angry people, they get over it after a while. Then after they get over, what happens is they regret the things that they did before. And that's what's happening here is that he's regretting. He's missing Vashti. And you know what? And the princes and the provinces, they're worried because he doesn't have his wife to be angry with anymore. They're going to be angry with the princes. So he says, we got to figure out what we're going to do. So they come up with this idea. Let's get all the single, unattached young women together, and let's let the king pick one of these women. And we're not going to go through the whole entire parts of the story, but this is when, and they have in a sense this idea, all these different women come into the king to see which one pleases the king, and whoever pleases the king the most gets to become queen. And then we're introduced to Esther, and we're introduced to Mordecai in verse number 4. And verse number 4, he says, and let the maiden which pleaseth the king be queen instead of Vashti. And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. So he says, okay, you're going to bring in these hundreds or thousands of the most beautiful women in all the lands, and I'm going to get to pick which one to be my wife. And the guy's like, okay, we can do that. Verse number 5, now in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, and that's a different Shimei than what most people remember Shimei, the son of Kish, a different one also than what we think of a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away with Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and it's another word, Jehoiakim, and whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So we see that they had been carried away with the rest of them. Verse number 7, and he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, and it's another name for Esther, his uncle's daughter. So we have Mordecai's uncle's daughter that he has pretty much adopted and is bringing her up. For she had neither father nor mother, and a maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. Now, do we know when this happened? No. Can we speculate that this might have happened when Nebuchadnezzar had brought them, and you know, many, many people lost their lives. Not everyone went to Babylon. Not everyone. Could that have been the time? We don't know. Could have been other times. There's different wars, different kingdoms, different, you know, transitions from Nebuchadnezzar to the Medes and Persians, all those different things. We don't know, but we know it's a tragedy. This little girl's an orphan. And she's an orphan here. Verse number 8, so it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace to the custody of Haggai, the Esther was brought also to the king's house and to the custody of Haggai, keeper of the women. So Esther is chosen because of how beautiful she was and how fair she was, chosen to be part of this trial and seeing which queen, which lady is going to be a queen. We're going to keep on going here and look in verse number 17. Verse number 17, the king loved Esther above all the women, and she attained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her and made her queen instead of Vashti. So we see here what happens is that Esther wins. It's amazing how God works all those details out. It's neat if you go through and read that in chapter number 2, how Esther was said, you could have whatever you want to try to impress the king. And she's like, I don't want anything. And it's, ladies, you go through and you read that, and you see how Esther was willing to just simply, she says, if I'm good enough for the king, I'm good enough for the king the way I am. Verses 20 through 23, we see here, it says something that's important to see. Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther did the commandment of Mordecai like as when she was brought up with him. So from this, I see that Esther was a child. She was brought up with him. She obeyed Mordecai, and we're going to get to that in a little while, but also she did not reveal that she was a Jew. Do we know why? Not particularly. We know that Jews many times throughout the years have always been persecuted for their beliefs. Verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, now this is a position sometimes that would be like a low entry type worker, somebody working at the palace, two of the king's chamberlain, Bigthan and Teresh, those are two great names, aren't they? Bigthan. And that's just, I mean, who would want to be called Bigthan? I mean, he sounds like he could be a thug that's going to try to kill the king. So Bigthan, you know. And it's a Bigthan and Teresh, those who kept the door were wroth and sought to lay hand on King Ahasuerus. So they're trying to make a plot to kill the king. And the thing was known to Mordecai, whom told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name, and when the inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore, they were both hanged out on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. So we see here what happens is Mordecai doing his job, sitting at the gate, he finds out, he discovers someone's going to try to kill the king, and they hang him for that. And Mordecai is written down in the chronicles, in the history books, of the fact of what he did to help save the king. Okay, in verse number 1 and 2, we are introduced in chapter number 3 to a wicked man named Haman. After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman. Most of us know who Haman is, the son of the Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him, and all the king's servants that served in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. So we see here in chapter number 3, we're introduced to a new man, Haman. Haman is an Agagite, and that shows that these are the people that gave Israel a hard time many times years ago. And they're from the Amalekites. And remember, Saul way back when was supposed to destroy all the Amalekites. He didn't do that. And because he didn't do that, they have these people that are still alive, and they're giving the nation of Israel a hard time again. And here Mordecai refuses to bow down to Haman. Haman gets mad. He gets wroth. He gets angry. And it says if you look in verse number 5, and when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did reverence, then Haman was full of wrath. So Haman gets really angry. In verses 9 and verses 13, it talks about how he not only gets mad at Mordecai, he actually gets mad at all the nation of Israel, because he realized that if Mordecai wasn't going to bow, that would be the same type of restrictions and the same type of laws, because Mordecai, the other guys came up and said, why won't you bow down to Haman? And they says, it's against my law. And I says, I understand the king's law, but I'm going to obey a higher law. And he believed that he was going to obey God by not bowing down to Haman. And in the story, he gets so angry, he gets so upset, that Haman actually goes to the king and convinces the king that we need to get rid of all the Jews. Look what it says in verse 13. And the letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women. And one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. So Haman is so wicked, and he's so full of pride, he goes home and he gets angry and gets upset. And they said, well, we should just get rid of him. So he goes to the king, who he's friends with, and he tells the king about this horrible nation that does not obey his laws and do not listen to him, which really is not true. And he says, we need to get rid of them. He even offers some of his own money. Look, I'll even pay to have it done. And the king gives him his ring. The king lets this letter be sent out and says, okay, on this day, it's like hunting season on the Jews. You kill the Jews, and whatever they have, you get to keep. And people are like, okay, well, that Jew over there has this. I'd like to have this. I'm going to put that person to death. And they're going to get paid for doing this. Well, chapter number 4, we see that the Jews find out about this, and obviously they're not going to be happy. And we see Mordecai in his response, who begins to, when Mordecai perceived, in chapter number 4, perceived all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth with ashes and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. So he has a burden here. He weeps. Verse number 2, and it came even before the king's gate, for none might enter into the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. So once again, he's breaking the law here again. He's entering at the king's gate with sackcloth and ashes, which is a way that the Jewish people would show mourning and would show their burden. Esther, in the verses later on, tries to send out her person that helps her and says, here, take him some clothes. Tell him to stop this. He might get in trouble. Stop this. Well, Haman, Mordecai wants nothing to do with it. Mordecai, he tells Esther what's going on. He tells Esther what's happened. Look what it says in verses 7 and 8 in chapter 4. Mordecai told all that had happened unto him and of the sum of the money that Haman had promised. For somehow Esther did not know that the Jews were going to be put to death, had promised to pay the king's treasury for the Jews to destroy them. Also, he gave him a copy of the writing of the decree. So Mordecai says, here to the person that's come out, he says, give this to Esther. This is why I'm mourning. This is why I'm crying out to God. And he says, he gave him a copy of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them, to show it unto Esther, and declare it unto her, and to charge her that she should go in unto the king to make supplication unto him, and to make a request before him for her people. And he says, look, Esther, you're the queen. You need to go before the king, and you need to ask the king to do something about this. You have the opportunity. I would do it if I could, but I can't do it. You have the opportunity. Esther reminds Mordecai something that knew was the truth, is that Esther says, look, if you go in unannounced or uninvited to the king, you're going to die. Unless he holds out his golden scepter, you're gone. And let's see how he responds here in verse number 14. Actually, we'll start in verse 13, when Mordecai responds back, and Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. He said, don't think just because you're in the king's house, you're going to escape. This is a law. And you imagine as queen, she probably had a lot of really great stuff. Verse number 14, for if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall thou enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. Mordecai is saying, look, Esther, if you don't do this, God's going to work some other way. Keep on going. It says, but thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And I preached on that phrase and that thought here. You know, God worked in all these providences to bring Esther for that moment, for that time, to save a nation. But you see, Mordecai is the person behind her who has trained her, who has raised her, and who is encouraging her to do this. Then Esther bade him return Mordecai with this answer. And then she says, look, okay, I'm going in. But for 3 days, we need to fast and we need to pray. Well, it doesn't use the word pray because nowhere in there does it talk about prayer in all the book of Esther. It's kind of interesting. The name of God is not mentioned in the book of Esther. It's the only book of the Bible that's not mentioned Esther. But you see God's providence in all this. He has put Mordecai in this spot. He has put Esther in this spot. Esther is here. Esther has the opportunity now to go on behalf of her people to the king. Well, chapter 5, verse number 3, we have the day. Esther enters into the outside courtroom and he says, who is it? And he says, Esther. And Esther is accepted by the king in verse number 3. Then said the king unto her, what will thou, Queen Esther? And what is thy request? It shall be even given to thee to half the kingdom. So it wasn't even just Esther, go chop off her head. No, he says, God gives her well favor in the king's eyes and says, look, whatever you want, I'll give you half the kingdom. Well, she requests something. She says, will you and Haman come over for a banquet? And invites her, and look what it says in verse number 6. And the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition? So the king asked, whatever you want, and Esther answers, you know, the king and Haman would come unto a banquet. Verse number 6, they get to the banquet. He says, what is it that I want? And it says, it shall be granted thee, and what is thy request, even till half the kingdom. So he says to Esther, what is it you want? This banquet isn't what you needed. And verse 7 says, then answer Esther and said, my petition and my request is, if I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleased the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I should prepare for them. And we'll do tomorrow as the king have said. He says, okay, come back to another banquet. It's sort of like, why won't you say it? I don't know, men, maybe you can understand this. Sometimes you just feel like, why don't you just tell me how you feel to your wife? So it's like, come on, just tell me what you want. You know you want something, please tell me. That's what King Asher is saying to Esther. What is it you want? I guess that went over like a lead bloom. Some husbands are laughing and smiling inside right now because they know exactly what. Will you just say what you want? You know you want something, just say it. And that's what King's saying. Look, what is it that you want? Now, God allows us, God's providence is in this all along. So Haman thinks he's pretty special. He leaves. And as he's leaving, he's going through the gate, and you know, everybody else is getting up, and everybody else is bowing, everybody else, oh, there's great Haman, there's great. And he walks by Mordecai, and Mordecai doesn't even move. Now, Mordecai he looks kind of rough. He probably hasn't bathed, you know, sackcloth, ashes there, just crying out to God. And he sees him, and he's disgusted by him, and he gets so angry and so mad, he goes home and pouts. Complains to his wife. Complains. It even says that he actually gathers all of his friends together. Look what it says in verse number 9. It says, then went Haman for a day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he stood not up nor moved for him, he was full of indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman refrained, which means he didn't go and do something to him right at that moment. And when he came home, he sent and called for his friends and Zeresh, his wife. And Haman told them, he brags about all the things that God has, the king has done for him. Verse number 12, Haman said, moreover, yea, Esther, the queen, she invited us to a banquet. And verse 13, yet this, all this availed me nothing. He says, I cannot be thankful or happy about any of this as long as I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting in the king's gate. And then, you know what? They come with this idea. Why don't we just hang Mordecai? And Haman thinks that's a good idea. We come to chapter number 6. We have to move because of time. Chapter number 6, the king can't sleep. Why can't the king sleep? We don't really know. I think it's God working in that. Maybe he's wondering what Esther wants. Maybe he stayed up all night saying, oh, I wonder what the queen wants. I wonder what the queen wants. But no. He's up. And so what does he do? He says, on that night, on that night, could not the king sleep. So what does he do? He calls for the history books to come out. I tell you, if you need help sleeping, you know, call out for the history books. I know what some of you are going to say. I have a couple of you guys that joke me and say the best sleep they ever had is when they listened to me preach. So you get some of those CDs in the back. You have trouble sleeping, just pop one in and you go out just like that. Well, the king here didn't have any of my sermons available online. So he calls up the history books, and in the history books, he begins having the records read. We all know that God has just made all this happen, and it's a providence of God. And here, under these record books, it's found written in verse number 2. What's found written? That Mordecai had told of that great name there, again, Bigthana this time, and Teresh, the two of the king's chamberlains, the keepers of the door, who sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. And he remembers, oh, this Mordecai guy, he saved me. And the king said, what honor and dignity have been done to Mordecai for this? And it came to find out there was nothing done for him. Well, Haman is upset and he's mad. He's out in the outer courtyard waiting for the king to let him in so he can see the king so he can ask about killing Mordecai. Well, king says, bring Haman in. And king says, look, Haman, what is it that we should do? How can we honor somebody that the king wants to honor? Well, Haman thinks the king's talking about him. So that Haman actually comes up with this great scheme of how a person could be honored. Let's look at this. I think this is kind of neat, and we won't spend much time here, but I think it's kind of cool. Verses 7 through 10, it says, Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let the royal apparel be brought which the king useth to wear. He says, let's get the king's clothes out, and the horse that the king rideth upon. Let's get the king's horse out, and the crown royal which is set upon his head. And let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man with all whom the king delighteth to honor. He says, now, dress this guy up to the tilt and just put him up on the king's horse. And then it keeps on going. And bring him on horseback through the street of the city. He says, now prance him around on the horseback and proclaim before him, thus shall be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. So Haman thinks, this is what king loves me. I'm king's second command. Who else is going to want to honor but me? So he says all these things so he can be lifted up in pride. But Haman's in for a rude awakening. Verse number 10, then the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew. And he says, look, that sitteth at the king's gate. Now it keeps on going, it gets better. Let nothing fail of all thou hast spoken. Then took Haman the apparel and the horse, and arrayed Mordecai, and brought him on the horseback through the street of the city. And Haman is the one that proclaimed before him, thus shall be done unto the man whom the king delights to honor. So you see God working all this out and God having all these things happen. Can you imagine what Haman would have been like leading him through the, you know, this is somebody who the king honors. Haman's built up gallows at his house to kill Mordecai, but God says, I'm not going to have anything to do with it. You know, if Haman in his position probably could have just taken Mordecai, had him put to death, you know, but God allowed all these things to happen just to keep him alive. Well, we continue on in verse number 7, chapter number 7. There's the banquet again, and we're not going to go for sake of the time. It's going to find out that the king finds out that Haman's the one that wants to put the Jews to death. Esther goes to the king, and he says, I'm just pleading for me and for my people's life, that there's a man that's trying to kill us and, you know, cause all these things to happen. The king, he gets upset, and it says in verse number 7, the king arising from the banquet and wine and his wrath went into the palace garden, and Haman stood up to make requests for his life to Esther, the queen. And so when they find out that Haman is one, Haman didn't realize Esther was a Jew. No one knew that she was a Jew. Haman realizes the king's mad at him, so he goes to the queen to try to convince her to beseech the king on his behalf, and keeps on going for his life to Esther the queen, and for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. And so the king sees this, he gets angry. And then in verse number 9, one of the chamberlains says, you know what? There's a gallows over at Haman's house, and they end up killing Haman at his own gallows. Says in verse number 10, so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. So we see here now that Haman gets his just due, but what's going to happen? There's still this decree. Esther goes in chapter number 8, begs the king for, you know, we need help. The Jews need help. I need protection. All these people need protection. In verse number 11 and chapter number 8, they make a new decree. because it was signed under the king's ring, you could not change the law. But in verse number 11, the king grants the Jews permission to stand up for themselves, wherein the king granted the Jews, which were in every city, to gather themselves together and to stand for their life. You know what they did? He gave them concealed carry permits. He said, Harry, look, you can stand up for yourself, use whatever force is necessary. And it says, together and to stand for their life, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all the power of the people and providence that would assault them, both little ones and women, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. So the saint says, look, stand up for yourself. I can't change this, but if they come, you can fight this battle. So God saves a nation. He saves a nation. What does he use? He uses one man and one lady. Here's a couple thoughts and we'll be done. First thing I want you to think about is Mordecai saw the value in investing in a young life, even one life. Mordecai saw the value of investing in a young life, even a one life. How did God save this nation? Now, God is providential. God could have moved the heart of the king. I know this, but God uses one man and one woman. Now, he doesn't use a group of churches. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But God uses one man with a mid-level job that no one knew, who adopted a foster daughter because he wanted to honor his dead relatives. He raised her the right way. He raised her to love the Lord. And I think it's important we understand, if we're going to declare the glory of God, we don't have to be some high exalted position. We don't have to be some highfalutin person. You know, Haman was used by God because Haman was just willing to do what was right. He saw a little girl that it was tragic. Can you imagine? You know, no mom, no dad. Our hearts would go out for her. And he saw this little girl and he raised her. He trained her in the right way. You can see from her description of her testimony in chapter number 2 and her responses when she got to the kingdom and her responses later on. You can see that she was someone who loved God and he trained her the right way. I tell you, if you want to declare his glory, you see the value of a young person's life. And he can see the value in all the young people, but he invests into one young person's life. I think we've underestimated the value of raising good children. I think it's that we see this one young person, when he had the opportunity to make the difference, he made the difference he could. So what are you saying? Well, I tell you, when they get older, sometimes they don't listen as well. I listen to many of you. I know my kids are in my house. They listen perfect every single day. Oh, maybe not. But but at the same time, as they get older, my kids just, I don't have as much influence on them. They're older, they're adults. What did we read in chapter number 2? Esther did everything that Mordecai had asked her to do when he was bringing her up. He had the opportunity to influence him as her child, and he took that opportunity. There was going to come a day that she might not have listened. If he didn't raise her right back then, you know what's going to happen later on? More than likely, they're not going to want to do what's right. I want to encourage you, especially parents with kids in the room, while you have the chance to make a difference, make that difference. Make that difference now. And I tell you, this is why we try to value our children's ministries. And I know sometimes they cost. I know it costs to run vans, and I know it costs to bring people in. I know it costs to have Sunday school classes and junior churches and Super Saturdays and Kids Crusade. But we need to value our children and value our children's ministries, because when we have the chance to influence them, we need to take that chance and do the best we can with it. Because many times when they become adults, even sometimes when they become older teenagers, they want nothing to do with you. Many times as a child, they have that tender heart, and we can reach and show love and demonstrate, and we can explain to them the importance of Jesus Christ and show them the great opportunity that's given in John 3:16. Someone who sees the value in investing in one's life. And you go back to Esther chapter number 2, Mordecai sees that. He sees this little girl. She's a pretty little girl. No mom, no dad. Probably died in some type of war or raid or whatever it was. And he says, I'm going to invest in her. I'm going to raise her. I'm going to train her. Second thing I want you to see is, I think Mordecai declared God's glory by simply living for a higher power, or for the highest power. Mordecai simply lived for a higher power, or the highest power. Mordecai was not a politician. He was not trying to get up the ranks like Haman was. He never said, what about my honor? I saved the king's life. Why can't I get exalted into a business? You don't ever see that. Mordecai just simply serves a higher power. You say he's waiting for God to make these things happen. You say, where do you see that at? Well, first of all, you see in the fact that he's not willing to bow. He did not, he broke the law when it broke God's law. And he says, I know the king said I need to bow to Haman, but I know it's wrong and I'm not going to bow down to Haman. I'm going to obey God rather than I am going to obey a man. So I believe his one desire was to honor God. He had a mid-level. He was not someone that had some type of position that really had great influence. He influenced the one he could in Esther. And he says, I'm going to honor God. I'm not going to bow. And I tell you, in all reality, if we're going to declare his glory, it's going to begin with what we bow down to. So I don't bow down to anything. Well, I tell you, what we use our time shows what we bow down to. What we use our checkbook says a lot about what we bow down to. What we use in our hobbies, in our leisure time, and our entertainment says what we bow down to. Mordecai says, I pledge allegiance to a higher power. I'm not bowing down to him because I believe it's wrong. I'm bowing down to God. But we also see that he simply lived to the higher power because not only is his bowing, but you see his burden. It broke his heart. He went and he fasted and he prayed and he cried out, sackcloth and ashes. You say, well, of course, Pastor, they're all going to die. I tell you, we live in a very, very desperate world today, in a very desperate situation in America. But how many of us really fast and how many of us pray? How many of us cry out to God? How many of us really weep over the issues that are happening in our lives and in our country today? I mean, when's the last time we really, truly cried and wept over, there's so many things, a lost soul? When's the last time we wept for our nation? When's the last time we wept for our family? And we fasted. And you see here, Mordecai was a man who had a burden. You also see how he was bold too. He served that higher power. You see that because he wasn't willing to bow. You see that because his burden, he's crying out to God. He's trying to get God's attention. He's trying to get a hold of God. And he was also bold. He looks at Esther and says, Esther, I would go talk to the king, but I can't. You can. Esther's like, it might cost me my life. Now, remember, this is not just some hardened older man trying to say, well, go ahead, who cares? It's just your life. This is a man who raised this little girl, and this is a man who loved this little girl and put his time and effort in this little girl. And he said to her, it's worth it. You know what? There are some things worth dying for. There are some things in this world that are worth living for. And there are some things in this world that is more important than our life. Acts chapter 20, verse 24 says, but none of these things move me, neither I count my life dear unto myself. There was a time in Christianity when people used to say, I want to go to the hard places. I want to do the hard things. I want to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. There was a time in Christianity when Christians didn't have to get worked up and motivated to serve him. They said, I want to serve God and I'm willing to do whatever it takes. You know, when Christ talks about discipleship, there's a difference between being a Christian and a disciple. He talks about things like this. Whosoever be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple. Denying, self-denial. Where is the preaching on self-denial today? Where is the talking? Where is it when we said, deny thyself, take up thy cross. Whosoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. He even says, if any man come to me and hate not his father or mother or wife and children and brother and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. Obviously, that verse is referring to the love that we have him in comparison to someone else means that we don't actually hate them, but instead the difference between the love we have for God and the love for people is so great, it looks like we hate them. Where is that type of love? See, I think Mordecai had that. I think Mordecai here, he's bold. He says to Esther, the one he loved, the one he says, Esther, this could be the whole reason why you're queen. I mean, you're sitting up there, you have all these things, all these people looking at you, all these people bowing down, but this could be the whole reason. It might cost me my life. And he says, it's okay, because there's some things worth dying for. I want you to also see, not only does he serving a higher power, and not only does he see the important investing in other person's life, I think Mordecai saw God's unchanging plan. He saw the awesomeness of God's unchanging plan. It was inevitable. He looks at Esther and he says to her in chapter number 4, he says, look, either you help or God's going to find somebody else. And I think you say, what's the point here? We got to realize something here. Either we do it or God's going to find somebody else. God is always going to win. God will always bring deliverance. God will find someone to do his work. God is giving you a chance to be a part of it. God has put you there so you can, but if you don't do it, you're going to miss the boat, and you and your father's house is the one that's going to be destroyed. You're the one that's going to miss out, but God will find somebody. God will win in this. God's church will go on. Whether we want to be a part of it or not, God's work will continue. God will see people saved. God will see God, you know, the gates of hell will not be able to conquer the church. I want you to understand something today, that God's plan will always continue. God gives us a chance to be a part of it. See, Mordecai understood that. Mordecai said to him, look, God is going to work out his plan. Details are going to happen. All these things are going to happen. But God is saying, I want to use you. And that's, if we really want to declare his glory, you got to say, God's saying, I want to use you. In the book of Romans, I think some people get the wrong idea. Sometime when you read that verse, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God. It's like God's begging you to serve him. So I don't think that's it at all. The verse at the end of chapter 11 that Paul penned, it says, for of him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen. So it's saying, for of him and through him and to him are all things. He owns it all. It's all his already. Now, I beseech you, because it's what's best for you, to get back in. And I says, I beseech you that you offer your bodies a living sacrifice. And you keep on going, and a little bit later on that verse in this chapter says, for I say through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to. Some people think, hey, God is just begging me. God needs me. God doesn't need us. God is giving us the opportunity. He's saying, I want to use you. And that's what Mordecai is saying to Esther. God has an unchanging plan. And whatever God's plan is, I'm going to do whatever it takes to be a part of that plan. Even if it means it costs my life. Even if it means I have to give up and I have to deny myself and take up my cross. If it means my life, I'm okay with it. If it means your life. And believe me, it'd be much easier for me to give my life than it would for me to give one of my children's life. It's okay. Because I want to declare his glory. I want to be a part of God's unchanging plan. That's what he says to Esther. He says, it's okay, Esther. God's going to make it happen, with or without you. I think God is giving us an opportunity to be on board. I hear stories, and I read stories more often than I hear. You read missionary biographies and preachers of old, of people, you know, I'm getting on this boat, and if I never come back, that's okay. I'm going to go and I'm going to serve God with all my heart, all my mind, and all my soul, recklessly abandoning this life for God. We just don't see that today. And it burdens my heart, because I want to be part of God's unchanging plan. And I should be willing to risk anything to be a part of that. Fourth thing I want you to see is he saw his advancement as a greater opportunity to help people. Go ahead and take your Bible to chapter number 10. We're almost done. There's only one more thought. But I want you to get these last couple, because they're probably my two favorite. For Mordecai the Jew was next unto the king Ahasuerus. He takes the place of Haman. He's the second in charge. He's the Joseph of the day. He's the Daniel of the day. And look at this. And great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people and seeking peace to all his seed. So we see here in this story, Mordecai is advanced. But what does Mordecai use this advancement for? He uses it for the advancement of God and for God's people. He doesn't use it for himself. He doesn't say, I'm going to take this opportunity, this advancement, become the big man on campus. I moved into Haman's house. I wear the royal robes. I wear the royal crown. He uses his authority and his power to seek the wealth of who? It says to seek the wealth of his brethren and of his people. I think that's amazing. I think he got it. He understood that when I get advanced, when I get the opportunity to have my influence increase, I'm going to try to help other people. I'm not going to think less of other people. I'm going to think more of other people. When I have an exalted position, when I get an exalted, raise or position or opportunity, influence, I'm not going to say, hey, look what I can get. Look what I can have. Look, no, Mordecai wants to declare God's glory and say, you know what? How can I help? How can I benefit and have a greater opportunity for other people? Last thing I want you to see is found in Esther chapter 8, verse 17. last verse. We got one more thing besides this. Esther chapter 8, verse number 17. And in every province and every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came. Look at this. The Jews had joy and gladness. They were happy, a feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land, look at that next couple words. We're almost done here. Became Jews. Now think about it. These same people were getting ready to hunt the Jews and put the Jews to death so they could have their stuff and have their, and they could spoil them and pray with them. Now they're actually believing in the same God that Mordecai does. That's my favorite verse in the Bible, in the book of Esther. It used to be for such a time as this, but when I look at this and I see that this was causing people to believe in the one true God, look, it says, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. I think that's great. He used his advancement, not to just help just his people, but it inspires them, and everyone else sees it. And as everyone else sees it, they say, I want the same God that Mordecai has, and I want the same God that Esther has, and I want the same God that was able to protect these Jews and change the heart of the king and see what happened to Haman. I want their lives changed. And that's what declares glory is. It's to clearly state the majesty and the honor and the power of God, to show people the greatness and beauty of God. Last but not least, Mordecai saw the presence of God in his providences. Mordecai saw the presence of God in his providences. You know, the subtlety of the providences of God is just as important as the grandeur of his miracles. Think about this. I'll say it again. The subtlety of the providences of God are just as important as the grandeur of his miracles. And we're going to close with this thought. Not one miracle in the book of Esther. All these things happen. Once again, a mid-level, low-level government worker who doesn't say she's married, who raises up his orphan uncle's daughter. You know, nobody knows him. But he sees God's hand all over it. You know, God's name is not mentioned in this book anywhere. But you see the providences of God all throughout, page after page, verse after verse. God is working, God is moving. And I want you to understand here that there's no miracle, but Mordecai still believes. I read in the story, I see miracles that happen. I see God, Jesus feeding the 5,000, and you know what? The next day, they're questioning him. I see the Red Sea be parted, and millions walk on dry land, and just days later, they're whining they want to go back. I tell you, you don't have to see a miracle to trust in God. You have to just believe he's there and that God is working. You don't have to see God do some type of great and magnificent thing to say he's worthy of my worship. Mordecai says, you know what? Even though my uncle and his wife lost their lives, I'm going to take care of this little girl. She's worth investing in. Even though all these things are happening, I'm still going to mourn and I'm still going to have a burden. I'm still going to cry out to God. He was a man who never saw a miracle, but he saw God at work. God is never mentioned in Esther, but he saw God move and work in his life. Now, this is just the thought here. Just because God is silent doesn't mean he's not there. Just because God is being silent at a point in time does not mean he's there, not there. You see God on every page. You see God's fingerprints on every chapter. You see him working behind the scenes and working out every detail. There may have been people in that day and time, I can imagine what the Jews would have been saying at that time, where's God? Where's God? Where's God? And in a day and time that we live in, we hear people say, where's God? Where's God? But as we read through the book of Esther, we see he is everywhere. And you may be in your ministry saying, where is God? Why can't I see God work? Why can't I see God move? You might be in your family's life saying, why can't I see him? Why can't I see him? Why can't God just step in and do something miraculous? Because he knows our hearts, and that many times we would forsake him anyway. But we can be like Mordecai. We can stay faithful to God and believe that God is real. And the subtlety of his providence, and look back in our lives and see how God has taken our lives and brought us to this point for such a time as this in the life that we're at and the church that we're in the country that we're in. We don't need the miracles because we know God is right beside us every step of the way, because we've seen him back there. We've seen what he's done. We see how he brought us to salvation. We see how he's kept us, and he has guided us, and how he's led us. And It's great to see the miracles. It really is. It's great to see something amazing, miraculous. But I can imagine if you went back in your life and looked at the times that God helped you and God's moved, you know he's real to you. Just like Mordecai, who could tell the one he raised, it's okay to die. It's worth it. Because he knew God was in it. Tonight, do you believe that God is in your life? Trust God like Mordecai did. Let's go ahead and bow our heads and close our eyes for just a second. I want to give you a couple of seconds, a couple of things.